Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Welcome to the Rock Contest. Funny, we've never thought of using accounting. Anyway, hello, Gary.
Hi, Guy. You've had your haircut. Look at that.
I have had my haircut, all three of them.
And you had a very nice lunch today, but we shouldn't say who
was. I had a very, very nice lunch, which looks like it's going to lead to a quite spectacular episode of this at some point. And I can, yes, I'm going to contain myself. But actually, I can barely contain myself anyway, because we've got a fantastic one. You know, someone I've known for nearly 40 years. You've known forever.
Yeah. Very, really excited. He's got a brand new album out called Jude, which came from the song Hey Jude. It is, of course, Julian Lennon. And really thrilled to have him on.
Really thrilled. It's lovely, yeah. And what's been nice is doing the deep dive and going back and listening to his records. Because I'm on some. I mean, there's one album on. And it was some stuff I'm really proud of, in fact.
No, actually, I have to say, I did listen to the track you're on today. What's it called?
No, I'm on that whole album. The track in particular is called Just For You.
I loved it. Your bass is fantastic on it. And so obviously you, it's got you written all over it, but it's beautiful. But I'm sure now I will avoid that anecdote for the rest of this interview.
Yeah, I'm going to put on a loop. That's my new ringtone.
Anyway, welcome to the Rock Contest.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. To
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hey!
Do I see before me two old muckers?
Indeed you do.
Hello, mate.
Charles.
I wish we were in the same room. This sucks.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Well, I just got into LA on the promo trail here, and it's, you know, it's full on. So
well, that's good.
And it's all right. But sometimes when you're traveling with jet lag, you can glide through it easily, and then other times it really hits you like a brick wall.
Yeah,
There is an age component that we have.
No, denial.
I was thinking about how fast time flies, because I was thinking about when the last time I actually saw you, because I know we stay in touch through social media. And we seem to know a lot about what we're both doing because of that.
Yeah.
But actually, I don't think I've seen you personally for nearly 30 years.
Probably.
The early 90s in LA, when there was that whole sort of LA scene, all of us hanging out together.
You're right. Absolutely. Time is a weird one, that's for sure. But sorry to interject. Go on, Gary.
No, it makes you concerned, you know, because you think, you know what, I take people for granted. We don't stay in touch enough.
He takes me for granted, Julian. Takes me for granted. It's shocking. last time I saw you was at Jake's Club Place, and it was it's probably 6-7 years ago.
But are you talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Well, I mean, Hugh, I don't know who's Hugh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Now, Guy and I are seeing each other quite a lot at the moment because we're playing in the same band,
too much,
Nick Mason,
too much.
And we're on our just about to leave to go to the US to do 6 weeks over there.
You are.
We are. Yeah.
Are you going to be out to LA way?
We are. We're doing the Orpheum.
Fantastic.
In October.
What dates do you have?
End of October. You may be gone.
Good.
By then, I'm not sure.
No. I'm here for 2 months as things stand.
Are you going to go out and play this album live?
I don't know yet. You know, I'm I'm actually going into rehearsals today just to, with a new band, preliminary for, you know, TV promo and stuff like that. And it's been a long time for me, and I'm just going to feel it out. You know, we've got rehearsals for the next 10 days, literally, and we're doing not half the album, but certainly a good few songs and some oldies too, just to,
yeah,
you know, see how I feel, because it's been that long, you know. And although
also, you've got big, ambitious arrangements and stuff to play on this album, haven't you? Which could sound fantastic live.
Some of it. Yeah. I mean, that goes all the way back to not even the last album, Everything Changes, or the one before it, Photograph Smile, which mm-hmm. was very, very orchestral, and we used orchestras from all over the world on that one. And there's quite a few on this album too. I mean, I had always said that if I do get back into that groove, that I would want to do, if I could get the support, of course, you know, performing arts theatres, which would tie it into my White Feather Foundation. So we try and help causes in every location that we play.
Want to talk about your foundation, which is fantastic.
And it would either be with a partial or full orchestra. That would be my limited engagements, you know. So not overkill, but at all, with a real purpose outside of music as much as the music itself. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about your, you know, two albums ago, which is, you know, quite a few years ago now, but
where
you developed what is really a sort of cinematic landscape sound in your arrangement, and how close that feels to me. Because that feels to me like you discovered yourself at that point, discovered what you wanted to do.
I tell you what it was. We were doing promotion for Photograph Smile, and we do a grueling 1 year promo tour, which was insane, really. But we ended up in doing a festival in Hong Kong, and it was the leading female Chinese artist, Boyz II Men, and me. I'm going, what? and it was a 3-day festival that we were circulating, you know. So it was like you didn't know what night you were going to be picked, and it was all a bit strange. But the most beautiful thing about it was we performed with the Hong Kong Philharmonic Orchestra, and when we did that, that was goosebumps for me. Mm-hmm. That was
live with an orchestra is always
that was pure joy for me. Beauty it was phenomenal. And so ever since I did that show, I've just been dreaming of doing something similar to that, you know, down the road. And again, if the right circumstances and the right setup came along and the right sponsorship, la-di-da-di-da, then I would certainly probably jump in quite deep on that.
Sorry, just to finish off on that, because what I think I was touching on as well, and I wanted to get to, was how close to me as an artist I feel your musical landscapes are to your photographic landscapes, to the dreamlike painterly quality, you know, those wonderful abstracts of clouds and you know, whatever you have that you manage to make look abstract, but also ethereal and quite, you know, I don't like the word, but spiritual comes to mind.
Yes.
And that you seem to want to get that kind of orchestration and depth into your musical work.
Well, it probably relates back to my initial inspirations, you know, from the artists that I used to listen to. I mean, not only did I find, you know, structurally, chord-wise and melodically, the Beatles to be pretty, fab, to say the least, but yeah, my earlier influences were certainly, you know, along the lines of, you know, Keith Jarrett.
This is an interesting thing, Julian, because I know you've said it, because I remember knowing you back in the 80s, and you've always you had the listener who loved AC/DC. But there's the composer which is a completely different ear, which is Steely Dan and Keith Jarrett. I remember that was always
exactly. Yeah. you nailed it. You nailed it. And you know, still are. I'm still the same in that regard. That's obviously I've built upon that a little bit. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Still banging my head once in a while, denying everything. And
and then you set up you lived in Notting Hill. You set your speakers up outside the window during the carnival and played AC/DC.
I did also. I almost died.
Foolish move.
This is true. I had some. I can't remember. JBL.
Very reactionary.
250 watt speakers, and I stuck them out the window because the reggae was driving me nuts. not that I don't love reggae, but I literally opened the sliding windows, sash windows, and put the JBLs in the windows. I mean, they were the size of a small person to begin with. They were massive, and then whacked on AC/DC full blast, and.
Mate, read the room.
There was a few people banging at the door. And then, of course, the cops trying to protect me and saying, turn that off. Otherwise, we can't help you. And I just, obviously, I bowed down. But that was a moment. That was a moment I will never forget.
I can see the way this is going to go. Guy's got to do the anecdotes, and I've got to try and somehow wheedle the album out of you. because you know, you mentioned Keith Jarrett, and there's a track on the new album, Jude, which is from a Bill Lawrence song or instrumental, you know, and which reminded me, because I didn't know Bill Lawrence, and I looked him up, Cables, I think it's from, and it reminded me of Nils Frahm. Do you know Nils Frahm? Does he ever come into your world?
That rings a bell, but off the top of my head right now, I couldn't focus on that. No, I wouldn't.
It's beautiful. You got Paul Buchanan from the Blue Nile on there, and I've forgotten who the French girl is, woman is.
Let me tell you how that came about.
It's stunning. It's like a menage a trois of music, right?
I think it's a gorgeous piece. It doesn't have a particular arrangement as such. It goes a little sideways. But I just felt it was okay doing that. I just felt, well, why should there be particular laws in music when it should just sometimes free flow? So I came across this band called Snarky Puppy.
I was turned on to Snarky Puppy by David Crosby. He's obsessed with them. They're incredible.
They're some of the best players in the world.
Bill Lawrence plays with Snarky Puppy, doesn't he? Bill Lawrence, writes with David Crosby.
There you go.
I read that today. Like that. Go on, carry on. Sorry.
I met those guys and fell in love with. Bill Lawrence's playing more than anything, because I keep saying to myself that had I actually become, I'm going brain dead a little bit. It's a practicing musician, which I am not by any standards. The only time I will curve sometimes, but I will come back. So, I tend to write for the purpose of writing. I play for the purpose of writing and recording, not for performing.
Means to an end. Right,
very much so. And so, you know, whenever I'm asked to jam, I go, impossible. I play by ear. I don't read or write music, so I feel cornered and embarrassed by not having kept up the playing, but there's something unique about being lost in that world and that music still being a mystery to me that keeps me going. But to get back to Bill, I saw them perform at Jazz à Juan in the south of France, outdoors, and my jaw dropped. They were playing every chord I've ever loved, and not dissimilar to Keith Jarrett, of course. And Bill, for me, was, if I'd have been a practicing a musician, I felt that that's what I'd be playing, the way he plays. And so I fell in love with his solo work as well. And at that particular point in time, he had an album called Cables that came out, which I absolutely... The only way I could describe it was Keith Jarrett and Steely Dan meet the soundtrack to Blade Runner.
Nice, yeah. How?
Along those lines. but... And so anyway, there was this one track that I absolutely loved that it just sounded French. I kept seeing the Eiffel Tower. I kept walking around Paris. You know, this is the vision, the smells, the sights, the cafe mm-hmm. culture. It was all of that. And it was just so French to me. And so he'd come over to my place and we were actually writing a few other songs potentially for this album, but they didn't quite sit, but nice tracks nonetheless that will find a home eventually. But I said to him, I said, listen, I really hear Cables, which was the album and title track, in a completely different way. And I told him about it and he said, no, I don't hear it. I said, you as a jazz musician can't hear what I'm trying to do with that. He said, no, I don't get it. I said, listen, just play the little upright in the corner and I'll sing the melody, the line, which is pretty much part of his song anyway. And he goes, oh, yeah, I get it. I get it now. And so I just asked him to record it. And I said, do you mind if I chop it up? I don't quite know what I'm doing with it. And then months and months later, I'm going through socials. And I kept dreaming about a French voice, a female voice. You know, the idea of it being sort of 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s radio or TV, just thin, and but typically French and just delicious in every way, shape or form. And I'm scrolling through and all of a sudden this beautiful girl comes on with acoustic guitar and I'm hearing this voice and going, that's her. That is her. So I immediately wrote to her and found out she lived 20 minutes away. I'm going, you've got to be kidding me.
This is meant sounds to be. Suspicious, right?
Yeah. If only. No, yeah. It didn't pan out like that. She had a boyfriend and all that kind of stuff. But
she sounds great. She sounds great on the record.
Yeah.
Well, the thing was, you know, I asked her about it and I sent her the track and I said, I'm kind of just looking for some spoken word. It's about, you know, conversation indirectly. It's a conversation between humanity and Mother Earth. And then the next day, she'd sent me the front part of the song. And I got goosebumps because she just recorded it on her iPhone, you know, with the speakers in front of her. And I went, God, this sounds so perfect. So I chopped out the front of the song and put her iPhone version at the beginning, which is what you hear, basically. And then I'd been trying to get Paul Buchanan, whom I love dearly.
Massively, wonderful artist. Yeah.
And we'd worked together years and years ago on Help Yourself album on a track called The Other Side of Town, which is still one of my favorite songs that I've written, and especially with him. But I said, Paul, because we kept checking in, by the way, during the pandemic, I said, you know, if I'm miserable in the south of France, you've got to be really miserable up north in Scotland where you are. Nothing had changed really up there. It was, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I said, listen, Paul, I've got this idea for a song. Would you be willing to do some writing on it and sing, you know, in this one section? He said, Jules, I'm really not in the headspace, blah, 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 blah. I don't think I can do it. I was saddened by that, but I sang it and I said, listen, do you think you could at least sing it for me? He said, Jules, all the studios have closed. You know, he's being Paul. There's nothing around, you know, everything's closed and everything's... I said, listen, I just did something with a friend. I didn't tell him about Elisa doing the other vocals. And I said, listen, have you got an iPhone? And he said, yeah. I said, have you got headphones? Yeah. I said, just record it. Six times. Just record it for me six times. He sent it back to me. I chopped it up, re-EQ'd it. Lo and behold, it's like he was in the room. And, you know, and then it was just a question of finishing the arrangements and putting the... And Elisa said, do you mind if I try and write some other parts? And when I got the chorus back from her, I again had goosebumps because the melody was not something I would ever have imagined. That was typically French, typically the timing, the way she said, and it just came together and it was beautiful and it just felt right to be the closer for the album, you know. Yeah. Just like it just thank you and good night, you know. Yeah. That's in a beautiful way.
But you find it, what's seems nice for you is it seems it's very easy. You clearly love the thrill of collaborating and you're totally comfortable working on your own. So I don't know if those are two completely different headspaces for you, or if it's just like I do this on my own, or I need to do this with someone else.
No, there are parts that I hear that are very, very specific. But I do, I get bored really, and I get stuck more often than not with writing. So friends in the biz, you know, send me bits and bobs, and I send other people bits and bobs, going, you know, have you got anything? So
I have not had a bit or a bob in my email box.
You're going to.
Okay.
Listen, there's lots of stuff that I'm going to be doing because. Let me just go back to something that happened that began the course of action of this, which was. About 4 or 5 years ago, my business manager retired, and so he said, "Listen,
we've got very conspiratorially."
No, we won't go there. It was a Zoom wink only.
he retired, yes. And so he sent me. He said, "Listen, I've got boxes that in the basement that are yours. I need to get rid of." I said, "Okay, send them over." So there were. Can I swear or not?
Yeah.
Oh, shitloads of boxes. and most of them were, you know, just financial files. And I'm going, oh, God, what am I going to do with this lot? But that's another story. All of a sudden, I come across literally about 4 or 5 boxes that have every format of recording and tape that you've ever had since the 80s, at least.
ADAT, Hi8. There you go.
The Elesis, the 12-track.
I'm getting flashbacks.
Oh, yes. Well, two of those songs on this album were done on the 12-track, one in a back bedroom, and the original vocal is still on it. After 35 years, but that's another story.
So you're saying this album was a compilation of a scrapbook of past losses, if you like.
Yeah. Yes, and no. In part, yes, because this box of tapes. On top, the first thing I found was the reel to reel, and it wasn't in a box. So I was friggin' angry, to say the least, of the original demos that we'd recorded on the Fostex, either 4 or 8 track in a barn in France when we were first writing for the first album.
All these formats to play. You still have all the machines to play all these things on.
I did have a few, and I brought in one or two as well. But the best solution was, I don't know, you probably know this form. There's a form, a process called baking.
Where they
take. So, baked all the tapes, but that was
Just to explain
months.
That. Otherwise, if you run them through a tape machine, all of the stuff with the music on will just fall off.
Yeah. So what you have to do is you have to bake it for 24 hours, and then you have one playthrough to copy everything off. And it mainly happened because all the old 2-inch tape used to be backed with whale blubber, and obviously they had to stop doing that. Yeah.
Wow. That's right.
And
yeah.
So, but the first artificial stuff they used. Was no good. They found out that was actually all rubbish. So it's all the tapes that first used the synthetic tape backing replacing whale blubber that all had to be baked.
Rubber. And can I wear my pinny when we do that baking job?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Most boring bake-off ever.
I was going to say, Gary, that's the baking show we'll be doing next.
Go on.
So we did all of that. And then, of course, we had more boxes with baked, you know, all of that stuff digitized. And so a little home studio, we started bringing up all the faders on Every Little Moment. and jaw dropped. It was like, bloody hell, this sounds like we recorded it last week in the next room. I mean, it really did. The quality was still there. So really quite shocked. And then I thought, okay, well, let's update the production on this, maybe change a few parts. A lot of the tracks back in those days, especially the place that you came to, Guy, on Mulholland, my little studio up there, it was all drum machines back in the day. So I just thought, okay, well, let's get a real player. So I found Ash Soane.
Yeah, I used Ash. Ash played on my solo album last year. And,
that's right.
There was Ash and Guy both at part.
So he's fabulous. So yeah, he set the tone and the groove for a lot of the songs on the album eventually. I used him on many other tracks. But once he'd done a few takes and I'd thrown a few other things, I just re-sang the chorus on Every Little Moment to give it a bit more punch. But the rest of the stuff was exactly as it was recorded over 35 years ago, plus whatever. And so I started delving, like Not One Night. That's the original vocal in my guest bedroom that I had the 12 track in that I sat there, just singing the demo for the first time. And that's the vocal. I've tried to re-record it. The whole song, I've tried to re-record my vocals, never quite captured that moment the way it did. So I thought, well, fuck it, I'm going to put it on the album. I embellished it with some new strings. I mean, again, going back to the instrumental stuff, not the orchestral stuff, I've been working with a great guy called Brian Byrne. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. Irish composer. He's a gentleman that I met whilst doing photography stills on a movie called The Price of Desire, which was about Eileen Gray and Corbusier, of all things. and he did the score on that.
Not arty, then.
I fell in. No, not at all.
Action movie.
I fell.
Well, Schwarzenegger as Corbusier.
That chair doesn't go with that wall.
And I wonder why I don't get hired for these gigs. So there you go. But true, where were we? Oh, yes, strings, Brian Byrne, look him up. Anyway, the arrangements on all the new material. Once I'd done the other stuff, COVID came along. My mate Justin Clayton, who
I was going to ask about Justin. I wondered if he was still part of your picture.
Yeah. I mean, we've fallen in and out of touch over the years, but of late, we got pretty. See, he's one of those guys that has a great memory. Mine predominantly is shit. It really is. So he knows, what strings on what guitar with what chord and what amp he was playing on that particular song.
Wow.
And that I was wearing a blue sweater at the same time. And I go, what? I don't know yesterday. How do you know that? So, and he'd just taken on an engineering course. So I said, come on down, let's go through these boxes. So he was the one who I was doing all of this with. So immediately it made sense to me that if this was going to become something, it would be a co-production,
right?
One way or other, with Justin Clayton and myself.
Oh, okay.
Regardless of how it leaned, whether I did more or he did more on particular tracks or whatever. Right. Anyway, of course, as we'd been working on a couple of tracks, COVID came along. He had to come back to England. He didn't quite have the same setup as me. So then we had to learn and figure out, how to work with the, with audio movers and a few other apps, et cetera, to be able to do this and try and finish the work that we were doing. And then because once he left, I had to remember how to engineer again. I hadn't done it for a long, 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 long time. And so the first track that I said I was missing not doing music again. So the first thing you know, it was quiet and lonely. And I thought, well, let's try doing a song. And the first song that I came up with finishing up and producing solo was Freedom.
Right.
And that, for me, in some respects, set some of the tone for the rest of the album. Because that kind of, not instrumental, but certainly filmic quality, that kind of landscape, audio landscape, Freedom was really, I fell in love with that. And I went, oh, this takes me somewhere. It really, really, really does take me somewhere. So that's really what kind of turned it into half quite deep, moody landscapes, as well as the slightly more up-tempo stuff.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Coming to interview you, there is this sort of slight trepidation on a friend's part, because this is public, of talking to you about your past. Because I know sometimes that's very much part of your life, and sometimes it's what you want to run away from. But this album, it's calling it
Jude.
And using that picture of yourself.
Come on!
Which, you know,
well, no, because
Maypang's picture...
I was going to say that because the fact it's called Jude, which is almost like a great acceptance thing for you, because you've always had a very ambivalent relationship with that song before, haven't you?
Hey
because
Jude.
Hey Jude. What it represents in terms of the reason it was written, for instance, is clearly not.
But it seems to me that there's a moment in your life now where you're kind of looking back and accepting certain things. Yeah. Is that true to say?
Yeah. I, you know, again, with the pandemic, being alone for so long, you know, I to keep myself from sort of going mad, I had to look inward, you know, figure out and do some figuring out about, you know, who am I? What does it all mean? How do I find happiness? Where is the balance? What is the balance? What will it take to achieve that? If I'm sad or down, how do I fix that? How do I fix the problems that I feel that I have? And that, of course, related to worldwide problems as well, and how we regard that. So I always look at this project as the wars within and the wars out there. So a lot of, you know, it was for me, it was very much a coming of age. In many respects, the journey that I've been on with the music, at least over the last 30 plus years. But I'd always had an issue because my given name was John Charles Julian Lennon. And so that was always a bother, because, you know, they got tight on security around the world. Because back in the good old days, you used to be able to fly around under all kinds of different names. So, you know, you go to the airport, and of course, having the name John Lennon, and not everybody would recognize me. You know, there would be certain quips. Some would be funny. Some would be smart ass. Some would be really dumb ass. I also had that going into, especially in America now, you know, if you go for a meeting in a building, there's about 20 steps before you actually get to see the person, and the security steps, and it, you know, and I just got sick and tired of all these weird comments that I was getting, and I, you know, I've always been Julian, you know, to me, I'd always been Julian.
But it's the idea, you're called John. Were you going to be known as John or John Junior or whatever? The fact that
Well, the thing was, Mum, when I was 3 to 5 years old, running around the house, would start calling me Julian because she'd say, John, you know, we'd both come running. So Julian took precedent. And so anyway, I'd had enough of this, and going through this whole growth period on many levels, I just thought, you know, I need to change this for myself more than anything. So in 2020, by deed poll, I went in. I still liked, loved, and wanted to respect both Mum and Dad in the sense that, you know, of the names that they gave me and the way it sounded when you spoke the name or the initials, JCJL, John Charles Julian Lennon. And I thought, okay, let me just switch those two. That's all I'll do. I'll pick Julian Charles John Lennon. And then the first name anybody sees is Julian. And this will put an end to it all for the most part. A little did I know. But for the most part, it's... So that's what I did.
But Gary,
once I became Julian proper, you know, there was a weight that dropped off my shoulders. Wow. There was, you know, I finally felt like me, and I, you know, me being Julian, me being Jules, me being Jude. So that's where it felt important to show that I'd come to terms and now felt like I owned the name Jude, you know, that I was taking control of that it wasn't just a sad song, it was making it better.
Fantastic. But I mean, wow, listen, but I think, you know, if I went into therapy now and I said, why am I writing songs? There'd be a moment in my life that made me begin to write songs and need to write songs. The fact that you've called the album Jude, which is, you know, now we all know that Hey Jude came from Hey Jules when Paul was coming to talk to you. Once that moment when that little boy's dad left home, that is the bit, the moment you get broken a bit. And it's the moment that all your music and maybe all your art comes from. And it feels that when I look at this album cover, that's what you're telling me.
Yeah, I think so. It was fine. It was really trying to find the love in all of that, you know, and the love in me to forgive, to find acceptance, and again to probably feel the most whole that I've ever been before. Mm-hmm. Taking all of that on board. So, and again with all the other things that have been going on Beatles-wise as well, with Get Back. Going to see that with Sean and seeing...
I heard you talk about that because Gary and I both went to the London equivalent of what you went to, that 100-minute thing.
Oh, the 100-minute one.
With
Paul,
the way you just talked about that was you made a really good point.
I didn't want to go. I really didn't want to go, to be honest with you. And Sean said he'd committed himself and he was here and I was here in LA too. And I said, all right, well, listen, let's go hand in hand and support each other. And just the way Peter Jackson broached that, the beginning of that, with his element of comedy brought into that. And he lightened the whole mood for everybody that was there. And I think that made a massive, massive, massive difference. Because the anxiety before that he did that was pretty heavy, you know, because I wasn't sure what I was going to see. But being with Sean and Stella and it's a shame Danny wasn't there, but it was a real community and family there. And I really did fall in love with Dad again, because what I saw on screen was what I remembered as a kid growing up with him, how goofy he was, what a smart ass he was, what a talent he was. And watching the dynamics between him and Paul and the rest of the band.
There's a way he looks at Paul when I've just never seen anyone look at anyone with that much love. It's just the most beautiful thing.
There's a couple of moments in that that just, you know, in some respects relive what I recall, you know, as early as 3 to 5 years old when they all used to hang out together at home, mm-hmm. you know.
They're so fast. The wit is so fast.
Julia, what's odd, and I is that they are all our artistic fathers. Because I sat there crying and laughing and smiling.
Yeah, same.
Because the importance of those guys to me and to all of us in our artistic lives is you just can't count it. You know, it's huge.
No. No, but
have been incredible.
Well, it was the same for me as everybody else. It really was. You've got to understand, Dad walked out of the door when I was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw him a couple of times after that. I wasn't included in the Beatles family from that point forward. You know, so I was a viewer of all of that just as much as anybody else was. I think that's where a lot of people are mistaken, is they think that there was a continued relationship, but it was few and far between and very distant, you know. So
as a young adult, you did say some quite blunt things, don't you? Which probably a lot to do with being that young
we all did
about all sorts of things, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, I'm sure I might have. I don't remember them right now. In denial, always.
They're things you said publicly. You know, that's.
Do you have anything in specifically in mind?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that as you go through your life, you know, you're reappraising what your relationship, and then you get to where we are now, and now you have a picture. Now you have a proper picture, whereas you're still formulating that at the time. There's times you're angry about your dad. I lost my dad very young too. There's all sorts of. It's only now that I can look back and see how he affected all the things that happened in my life. You don't know at the time.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. No, very much so. No, you have to see the bigger picture to really understand what it was all about.
What's funny about that? What's exciting about that film is you watch you see, you know, we're, first of all, I'm surprised they're young men, because I always think of them as being so much older. But actually, they're kids. They are kids.
Yeah.
They've gone through this they've created so much already. But then you look at John, you look at Paul, you think, my God, you've not even done half of the brilliant things you're going to do.
Yeah.
Because what comes next is phenomenal in both of their careers, you know, and George's, of course. I love the fact that you first played drums and recorded with your dad, you know.
That's an amazing
great baton passing that was. Well, or drumstick, anyway.
drumstick it was. That was a lovely moment.
The funny thing is you didn't go on from that and become a drummer. It didn't shape you
funnily enough, I had a drum kit when I was about 7 years old. I remember that. And I remember seeing if it could float in a pond or a pool.
You weren't Keith Moon, were you?
So I was going to say, so you got straight to Keith Moon.
I think I did. Straight in there, no waiting around. Straight to Keith Moon.
Yeah, I'm not
going
to be able to drive for years. So let's just get the kit in the pool.
Well, that was it.
We have to talk about, because I know we don't have terribly long with you, and we really must talk about. I mean, first of all, I just want to say, because I know Guy wants to talk about your foundations, but what amazing photography! I mean, your work starting with U2. I love that shot of Bono with in the background. You see Astrid's shot of John and Stu.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about one picture telling us a whole short story. That's it.
That photograph was literally, that particular picture changed my life and changed how I approach photography, because I'd been with the guys for a day or two on and off. And I was staying next door anyway. And, because I was heading off to New York for my first ever photography show at the Morrison Hotel Gallery, which was the old CBGB. And Edge had said to me, he said, I know you'd like to take a few photos, so let me talk to the boys. So he did, and they said, yeah, it's okay. But, you know, I wasn't close friends with them at that point. I'd known them over the years, but they've got a particular wall around them. You know, they're pretty tight-knit, their family, you know, the real inner circle. So, and I've always been relatively shy. I think you know that as well in certain circumstances. And so I didn't know how much time to spend in and out of their presence, so to speak. And I was staying at my friend's house next door, and I would take a few pictures and I'd go back and I'd go, these look like shit. They look like holiday photos. I just wasn't capturing the moment. And I think it was on the second or third day, everybody else had left, and Bono was there. He was just thinking and writing and staring out of the window. And so I just came and sat on the wood floors next to him. We were just chatting away. And then I just lay down on the floor like this, as if I was, because I was uncomfortable. And I just looked up at him and I went, fucking bloke, Jesus. There was Astrid's picture in the back, him in the front. And to me, it struck me, it's all about perspective. It's all about angles that changed everything in one go. And from that point on, that changed how I approach photography entirely. And initially it was called, because I loved the idea that Bono, I respected immensely, was a hero of mine, as was Dad, blah, blah, blah. Initially it was called the Lennon Sandwich.
Yeah.
probably wouldn't have gone down so well, but someone to look up to was a much better title for that. It really did change the way I looked at things, and it was just it was magical. And then, you know, again,
because I don't care what people say, but I do think that the great photographers are part of their photographs too.
Yeah,
you know, you're watching their story as well, like just any artist. You know, Picasso's paintings are about him.
For me, again, being quite a shy one, I didn't want to get in their way at all. So it was very much, you know, just being a fly on the wall as much as humanly possible. You know, I wanted to capture some more of the beauty and more of the depth and emotion that they were going through at the time.
Your composition is so good with landscape and everything. I mean, you really are. I did a really brilliant photographer, Julian. And in a way, that's kind of, rather than it being a photograph of people and an icon, that's the same sort of landscape ethic applies to that picture.
I think part of that came from the fact that, you know, I have been on a couple of traveled the world, and I've been on a couple of, you know, White Feather Foundation journeys where I took the camera along. And once I'd done a couple of exhibitions, you know, showing, you know, where I was, what I was seeing, what I was feeling, what, you know, the space I was in, you know, I kept getting emails from a lot of people saying, you know, what you're doing here, Jules, is, you know, there are people of us there are people out there that just can't afford to travel, or there are people that are disabled and can't, you know, physically get to these remote places around the world. And, you know, they've said to me time and time again, you know, you take us to these places, not only visually, but emotionally too. And once I heard that, I really responded to that, and I just went, yeah, I get that. It's almost I can't even describe the words I would normally use, but it's sending a message of what I'm really physically seeing and feeling. Mm-hmm. I think in those photographs, I just try and capture that. And if the picture moves me, I think it's the same with songwriting.
If it moves me,
you hope it's going to have some effect on everybody else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But so, Jules, I know apparently we're running out of time here. I just want, so now your White Feather Foundation, which is a fantastic thing. There's one little key thing that interests me, because it's such a powerful image that started it, the idea of the white feather, which apparently was some Aboriginal elder who presented you with it, in Australia, was it? But how did that meeting come about? That's what I'm interested in.
So I was in Australia with my first number one in the world. Yay! With Saltwater Environmental Humanitarian Song.
Great track. Great track.
Yeah. And I think it was Adelaide. And I was a dear friend of mine had been working with this tribe called the Murning people. Kim Kindersley, Kimbo, whom I believe you know. Yes.
Guy knows Kimbo. Everybody.
So, he does.
Just think of two random names and stick them together. He'll know the guy.
There's no question about that. That's a given. I'm in the hotel room. We're touring at the same time. And I get this call, saying, Mr. Lennon, there's a news cruise, which I figured, okay, that there might be for the situation. But there's also an indigenous tribe of about 30 people down here, and they'd love to see you. And I'm going, yeah, sure there are. I thought it was a prank, on the road prank. And they called back again and said, no, they really are. Would you come down and meet them? So I came down. There's Kim, of course, Kimbo. And I step up to this kind of plinth, semicircular, platform, lounge area. And there's all these Aboriginal people none of whom I've met before, and with news crews. And the elder called Iris, who sadly passed last year, she walked up to me in the semicircle and just handed me, a male swan's white feather that was about yay big. And she said, you have a voice. Can you help us? And, right then and there, I thought, okay, what do I do? Just keep being a rock and roller, or do I step up to the plate? And I didn't really understand fully the implications of all of that. But I said, yes, of course, I'll do what I can for the children. Then I spent 10 years making a documentary about them called Whale Dreamers, and about 80 other tribes around the world that came together to tell their stories. And they've all been through the same shit. All kicked off their land, all used and abused. Religion came into play, and that screwed everything up for everybody. But the real key here, the real thing that made this more real and more true was the fact that Dad had said to me at one point, and I couldn't tell you where and I couldn't tell you when, but he did say it. And it stuck with me because I thought it was such a weird thing. But he said that if something ever happened to him, the way that he would let me know or let all of us know that we're going to be all right, or that he was going to be all right, it would be in the form of a white feather.
Wow.
So when I got that, the goosebumps hit me, and I just went, I'm sorry, but, regardless what anybody thinks, if that connection isn't real, then it blew me away. So hence the White Feather Foundation started, and we've been just working on health and education, clean water.
I'd advise anyone to go and look at the website, because there's a list of all the fantastic work you're doing, and how you can get involved.
Exactly.
You're a good man, Julian, really are. Yeah. A massive heart.
It's been fantastic
having you on, and I haven't even got to the bottom of who's got the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds drawing. Is it David Gilmour?
Which, because I asked David about that today. Who sent his very best, by the way? That's David Gilmour.
Thank you. Okay, and, go on.
Yes.
He
had it on the wall, didn't he?
He has the one.
He's not even saying it's necessarily the real one.
Mum and I, before she passed 7 years ago, she and I talked about this a lot, and we don't believe it is. Not to dishearten
David was never sure. He came to him through Willie Wilson, who's the old childhood friend he used to play.
Yeah, I kind of recognize the image, but I don't believe it's the actual image. No one will ever know
unless they do a DNA test, obviously.
I don't know. No, because I think I absolutely think I did draw that, but I don't know if it's the actual Lucy in the Sky. That's what I'm saying. Because I would come home every morning or every afternoon from kindergarten with a new drawing for Dad or Mum or whatever. You know, so
such a good boy. Such a good boy.
You know, but he's not a good boy to his publicist, who's banging on our head saying, you have to go.
Sorry, we're getting terrible. They'll never let us speak to anyone ever again.
We're fine. It's all good. We're all mates here.
We're gonna meet up. Hopefully, when we get to LA, end of October, we'll give you a call and come to the show.
It's not before, because I think my little London jaunt promo will be at the beginning of October.
No, we'll be in America, mate. We're in America.
You'll be in America. But well, then I'll see you out here then.
You will. Definitely. I'll be in touch. Make sure you can get to the LA gig.
Lots of love.
I'll make sure of it. I'd love to see you guys.
Massive pleasure talking to you.
Mate, it's so good talking to you.
Likewise.
See you, Jules.
Yes, let's keep in touch, mate.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. All the
best.
See
you on Instagram.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Love to you both. Man. Okay. Bye. Speak soon. Bye.
That was good. I felt that you had so many anecdotes in your duffel bag sitting there, and I'm sorry I didn't let you pull them out, you know?
No, you did the right thing, because it just would have been, it could have turned into Blokes Down the Pub, whereas you had, really, as usual, great sort of grown-up pertinent questions, which are of much more use to our listeners than a cheap joke, which is all I have to offer in that situation. but the really lovely stuff from him there, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I think he was really enjoying it.
Pretty much all of the Western, the world, shall we say, wanted to know what those guys thought when they looked up and saw their dads on that screen that day. And I think Julian gave us a little hint as to what it must have felt like.
Yeah, because the other thing he'd said, by the way, when he's talked about it before, is not that he's, which is so true, was the fact that Peter Jackson gave these little interjections where he would prepare you for the scene that was coming up, which, of course, we didn't really think about, Gary, right? When you saw it, you just think, oh, okay, this is what's coming up. Whereas Julian said that was so helpful to not get tripped up and kind of, do you know what I mean? What you're about to see. It was, like, really good to be prepped.
Yeah. Oh, that was good. I really enjoyed that. I hope we get to have a cup of tea and see him in LA. Like,
yeah, I've just got a text saying he'd love to do part two at any other point in time.
Very nice. And thank you for his publicist for cutting it short. We were a bit upset about that.
So yes, dear listeners, we could have gone on for hours and hours and hours, but
anyway, until next week, it's good night from me
and good night from them.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.